ladies and gentlemen, shall we make a start? I'm absolutely delighted to see so many people here. I'm Charlotte Clark. I work as the International Dean for the College of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences, and also as the head of the School of Health and Social Science. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome you. I'm going to just do a little bit of a brief background around where we are and around the nursing studies department in the university, and then introduce our speaker today, Professor Roger Watson. So just very briefly, the University of Edinburgh, as you may know, one of the ancient universities of Scotland, founded in 1583, and it's gone from strength to strength in many ways. So now sitting at about 37,500 students in the university, 13,000 staff, and this year, 2016, in the top 20 of the QS World Rankings. So a university that has always seen itself as leading the way. Part of that is actually in the building that we're in here, this magnificent Playfair Library, designed by Robert Adams in 1789. It's 190 foot long, so it takes an awful lot of people to fill this building. And it was a working library until the 1960s, actually. It paused, having been designed by Robert Adams. There was then a pause in the building here for the Napoleonic Wars, and it was completed in 1816 by William Playfair, after whom it's named. So let's just turn our thoughts to nursing studies. 2016 sees nursing studies at the University of Edinburgh celebrating its 60th anniversary. That's remarkable, the first academic department of nursing in Europe. There have been several events to commemorate this 60th year throughout this year, including hosting the Royal College of Nursing International Research Conference in April and a visit from the Chancellor to Nursing Studies, which was also in April. It was a busy month for us. The students organised a celebratory ceilidh in May, which was attended by staff, alumni and students. And tomorrow, there'll be the Leaps in the Dark Alumni Conference, bringing together staff, students, supporters, and especially our alumni, our former students. Tonight, we have the prestigious Elsie Rick Stevenson Memorial Lecture to be delivered by Professor Roger Watson, who's both an alumnus and a former member of staff. I'll say a little bit about Elsie Stevenson Memorial Lecture. It's a biannual event in nursing studies and is traditionally delivered by an alumni to commemorate the work of the founder of nursing studies, Elsie Stevenson. It's reported that Elsie decided to become a nurse at the age of 3 after her father died in the 1919 influenza epidemic, and her timing was fortuitous as the role of nurses during the First World War greatly enhanced their status. And the Nurses Act of the same year introduced registration and began a journey to professional status. Despite this increase in professionalism, Elsie had failed her school leaving certificate examinations, and her subsequent career, which included community nursing work in Newcastle upon Tyne and overseas work during and after World War II on behalf of the British Red Cross Society, did not make her an obvious candidate for the post of Director of Nursing Studies Unit. And the appointment was not met by approval amongst the senior nursing establishment, partly because she was considered an outsider and partly because she wasn't a graduate. But in time she overcame this opposition, built confidence and became admired for her commitment to building academic nursing in the university. Her biographer, Sheila Allen, puts this down to her no-nonsense, practical personality. She wrote, "Elsie carried out her role of ventilating stale areas in the nursing world, thereby allowing the wind of change to blow through with panache. Her skills of oratory were enhanced by her genius for annexing the wisdom of others." I don't think I've ever heard a definition of nursing leadership quite like that before. It's wonderful. Elsie Stevenson was the first Director of Nursing at the University of Edinburgh. It began in 1956 with the establishment of the Nurse Teaching Unit. It was renamed the following year as the Nursing Studies Unit. The University of Edinburgh demonstrated exceptional wisdom in being the first university in Europe to establish nursing as a discipline, And this vision was not only about nurse education. Right from its inception, Elsie Stevenson and Nursing Studies emphasised the value of research and appointed two research fellows in its first year who were funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. Nursing Studies has a long tradition of being one of the most research-active nursing departments in the UK, and our social sciences perspective gives a clear focus to much of the research work, whilst not precluding some excellent and professional work with other colleagues from medicine and science and engineering. Nursing Studies continues to have a vibrant community of postgraduate research students, with 38 PhD and MSc by research students currently enrolled. I'm delighted that quite a number are here with us today. And our global influence through both education and research aims for better patient care and health and well-being on a truly international scale. Nursing Studies are now in the final events of the year and the culmination of the celebrations. So I hope this evening will be a tremendous success. I'm sure it will be. And it's my absolute pleasure to introduce Professor Roger Watson. Make a few observations, if I may, a few introductions. So Roger completed his first degree at Edinburgh in biological sciences in the 1970s and has a PhD in biochemistry from Sheffield. He went on to train as a nurse at St George's Hospital in London and specialised in the care of older people. He worked in this speciality for a number of years, up to the level of senior charge nurse, after which he took up post in nursing studies at the University of Edinburgh as lecturer. Roger became senior lecturer and senior warden, and then reader before moving to Dublin for his first chair post. He has since held several professorial appointments at Hull, Sheffield, University of Western Sydney. He's also been editor-in-chief of the Journal of Clinical Nursing and is currently editor-in-chief of one of the highest-ranked nursing journals in the world, the Journal of Advanced Nursing. Now, Roger is not without ambition, and he lists a number of goals that he sets out to achieve. One is to make his journal the number one in the world rankings. Two is to take his school to the top 10 of the UK research rankings. Well, I hope as your alumni that you're proud of where we sit in that. Three, to maintain Diamond Card Flyer status with Cathay Pacific. It's obviously a big achievement, that one. Oh, and then some that are kind of very energetic ones. To run 5K in less than 21 minutes, to run 10K in less than 45 minutes, half a marathon in less than 1 hour 45 minutes, and to run a marathon. That's exhausting to think about. But Roger also has something of a military history as well, holds the Gulf War Medal, Liberation of Kuwait Medal, and the Saudi Liberation of Kuwait Medal for services as a nursing officer with the British Forces Middle East in the 1990 to 91. So a man of many talents and a long-standing and very much valued colleague to staff in nursing studies at the University of Edinburgh. So we very much welcome you, Roger, to deliver this special lecture in our Diamond Jubilee Year of Celebrations towards a public understanding of nursing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me? Good. I thank you very much for the introduction. That was wonderful. A little bit more than I would have said about myself, perhaps. And thank you, Sheila, for the introduction. I'm just going to take my watch off so I can keep an eye on the time. I'm not going to use the podium because I'll fall off. And I'm very suspicious of these roving mics. They're great things. I prefer to use them than standing behind the podium. But I was telling Sheila earlier, I was in Munich about 3 years ago, and I was giving a talk at some university or other there, and I was mic'd up, and I was a little bit worried. I said, look, it's a while to go. I said, don't worry, it's not on the base. It's only on here. So I said, right, okay, can I go to the toilet? And you know what's coming next. And there was a door behind the stage. I said, this is just through there. I said, fine. I went down the corridor. Meantime, some comedian had turned on the bass. So I walked back into a hall of 300 people, Germans, killing themselves laughing. So two things, Germans have got a sense of humour, there's a German here tonight, one of our former students, and be very careful with these things, always make sure they're off. So the first thing I got Sheila to show me was where the mute button was. Right, well, you know, I feel very grateful for the invitation and almost not worthy. I look back on my phone on the way up today and on the internet to check the previous orators, a couple of least of who are here tonight, Fiona Smith here, and Anne-Marie Rafferty, who kicked this off, I think. You were the first of the orators for the Elsie Stevenson Memorial Lecture, just before I left Edinburgh, in fact. And I kind of never thought I'd be doing it, and I'm really, really grateful. And what I want to do is talk about public understanding of nursing. I'm going to keep it light. It's not about my research as such, but of course I'll slip some of that in. It's not about the Journal of Advanced Nursing, but of course I'll slip some of that in. And mentioning the Journal of Advanced Nursing, I have to say, I don't want to single out too many people in the audience, but I'm absolutely delighted that Jim Smith is here tonight, who's the founding editor of the Journal of Advanced Nursing. And I don't know if Jim knows it, I don't know if I've ever told him, he's been my mentor for the last 20 odd years, and I simply would not be where I am now if it wasn't for Jim. And there's at least one other person without whom I wouldn't be where I am, and that's Professor Ian Deary, and I'm going to mention some of the stuff we've done together later. There's two really great colleagues here, and lots of other people who are too many to mention, so don't feel offended if you haven't been mentioned. Now, it's working, that's good. Always a tense moment. Just greetings from Hull, okay? I work and live in Hull now, and at least I'm somewhere where I don't have to apologise for my accent. I usually have to go around the world a lot, so my accent's Scottish, you'll maybe not understand what I'm saying, but most people here will get my accent. That's the Humber Bridge, which is 2 miles long. It was the longest suspension bridge in the world until they built the one from Lantau to Hong Kong, in Hong Kong. But it's still a pretty magnificent sight of Hull, and pretty good for running across. So that's the best view of Hull that I can possibly give you. It's not actually in Hull, it's outside Hull. But it reminds me of Hull. They say there are only two ways to get to Hull. One is by the A63 and the other is by mistake. But I think it's very unfair. And we're coming up to a year of culture in 2017, and I hope people will come and visit us there, because there's a lot of really good things going to be going on. Now, I hope you can see these slides from the back. Not quite starting on a public understanding yet, but I'm just reflecting on my own education as a nurse. I was a biochemist beforehand, and did biological sciences, then biochemistry, then came into nursing. And I'm commonly asked why. I'm not going to quite explain why. But the very first lecture we got was Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs. Now, I never met anything like this before in my life. I was a hard-bitten scientist. I didn't understand all the stuff about self-actualization, whatever it was. I'm not very sure there's any empirical evidence for Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs, but I'm really glad that it's been updated recently, and there's been more research done into it. And it shows that actually one of the most basic needs is not the most basic need is for Wi-Fi, and under Wi-Fi the most basic need is for battery power, and it's never true or more spoken. So I'm glad to see that Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs has been expanded and still useful in the modern age. Now, I'm delighted to see a couple of people in the picture here. Phil Runciman in the middle is here tonight, but I'm going to pick out Elizabeth Nicholson, who's here, the better. She's waving at the back, sitting up there with Ireland. And Liz and I have been corresponding on almost a daily basis since, I don't know, since either she discovered I was doing it or found my email or whatever. It's just been great fun. I really don't. You could base a lecture on Elsie Stevenson around the things that Liz has told me about her. And I didn't know Elsie Stevenson, of course, at all. But there's too many things to recount, really. But Liz was one of the first intake, and I believe she's wearing that badge tonight, which is the Nursing Studies badge. And Liz came to the end of her training, and just to show what sort of person Elsie Stevenson was. Liz couldn't afford to buy the badge, which had been made and crafted for that particular the first output of nurses from the programme, and Elsie Stevenson bought the badge for her. That was a beautiful story, just showed you what she was like. And of course, Elsie Stevenson died far too young, and Liz knew her right up until the very end of her life. And I'm sure that all the people you remember her very, very fondly. But that's Elsie Stevenson on whose memory this lecture is based. So, what I wanted to do was start off with people I want to hit, because there are people I want to hit. That's a Pro Vice Chancellor, Pro Vice Chancellors have a habit in Russell Group and other universities of saying, I could almost be a nurse. And the reason for this is that they have had something to do with bringing nursing into the university and helping to develop it and keep it there. And they think that this kind of peripheral contact with nursing makes them a nurse. It's strange how people think it's something that's easy to do, doesn't require much other than a little bit of exposure to whatever it is that nurses are exposed to. The last person who said that to me was an engineer, and I said, I once fixed a plug, and I could almost be an engineer. He didn't take it too well, I can assure you. The other people who annoy me at the other end of the spectrum are nurses who say, I'm only a nurse. And I think it just shows, and this happens all the time, people stand up, they introduce themselves at dinner parties, now, what do you do? I'm an engineer, I'm a lawyer, I'm a doctor, I'm only a nurse. And really want to reach across, you know. Now, I've got two daughters who've gone into nursing. My oldest two daughters are in nursing, and I've warned them within an inch of their lives, if I ever hear them saying this, that they're not too old for a scalp across the room. So, that's a sort of general background to this thing. I mean, I just feel that people don't really understand what nursing is about. I'm not here to apologise for it, and I know that many people in the room are nurses, but I just wanted to try and propose some arguments which might help people to understand nursing better. So why towards a public understanding? Why specifically the title? Well, what's behind that there is the first Lancet Commission on Nursing from 1932. And I'll get to the point in just a minute. And there was another Lancet Commission commissioned a few years ago, which I was asked to lead. I led it for a few years, and I've led it for a couple of years, and I've since resigned from Anne-Marie Rafferty's in charge of the Lancet Commission now. Hopefully it will report before too long. But when we announced the Lancet Commission, we got such a vibrant and positive reception, not that it's unbelievable. I mean, the nursing standard went to town on us and just said, what on earth is this about? Why on earth would you be doing something like this? This year, Claire Warnock, one of my former colleagues from Sheffield, you know, the Commission exemplifies many of the systemic conditions that have contributed to problems with the image and reality of nursing in the past, infuriating, etc., etc. And then Tony Butterworth, another old colleague, got in. Whatever next, I wonder, the nursing standard doing an investigation into medicine or whatever. And this is just, again, our own fault. It's typical in a way of nursing. We don't just shoot ourselves in the feet. We saw them off. You know, we really make a job of it. So it was just a very, very odd reaction to the whole thing. It was a great honour that the Lancet took an interest in nursing. The Lancet doesn't see itself as a medical journal. It's a global health journal. Nursing's part of global health and whatever. But I know that everybody wasn't too happy about it. And of course the gender balance was wrong. There was too many academics on it, whatever. We hadn't even started when we got this sort of publicity, which was not very positive. However, what was really good about the Lancet Commission was I met this wonderful woman called June Gervin, and she's from the Oxford Brookes University, and she'd written, in the early days of the Lancet Commission, she said, it would be really great if we could establish a lectureship or a professorship for the public understanding of nursing. And, you know, we have public understanding of science lecturers at Cambridge, not all that keen on the incompetent Cambridge, but never mind, but this is an interesting idea. And she wrote an editorial in JCN about it, public understanding of nursing, you know, time for a step change. And she picked up on a radio programme, which is unfortunately, you still get this webpage, you can't listen to it anymore, but it was interviews with new student nurses going through the training. There was quite a bit of exposure of nursing, some of it good, some of it bad on Radio 4 for a while. And this was interesting. It was interviewing nurses about why they went into it, what they thought about nursing. And it was very interesting. The comments were things like, nobody really knows what a nurse is. This is what the students were saying. They'd gone into this profession, but you know, they couldn't really offer an explanation themselves. In the same editorial from quoting Linda Shields, she said, you know, the stereotypes of heroin, harlot, or whatever, handmaiden, you know, we find these repeatedly. So nursing seen as being these sort of things. It's an odd attitude towards the profession, which I find difficult to understand, but clearly indicates a misunderstanding. So, if you ever want to really catch up on things about media images of nursing and other aspects of nursing. This fantastic book written quite a few years ago by Suzanne Gordon called Nursing Against the Odds. It's really worth reading. It's from the States. We tend to think in the States things are better than here, but there's some, the image of nursing there, the attitude towards them can be quite poor. It's very, very well worth reading. I just thought I'd slip that in as a reference, and I thought the picture sort of says it all. But we're either seen, I hope nobody sees me like this, seen as being angels, excuse me. We're either seen as being angels, which is, I think, is patronising, we're just human beings. People seem to think that you need some special quality to be a nurse, so I'm not very sure about that. We can maybe talk about that later, I know we've got question time later. But when things go wrong, like in the Mid-Staffordshire inquiry, which things really went badly wrong there, it's I don't know if anybody's read the whole report. I haven't read it all myself because it's massive. But and I'll come back to some of the things that emanated from that. But this was a terrible, terrible affair of poor patient care, patients being neglected and such like. But very quickly we became demons. Everything was wrong with nursing, and particularly everything was wrong with graduate nursing. Why did nurses have to go to university? It's all gone to hell in a handcart and all the rest of it. So there's something about this almost ambiguity in the way people hold us in terms of a public image. We're either angels who can do no wrong, or when we do wrong, we're demons, and particularly we're demons if we've been educated into the job. And I'm going to pick up on this issue of education later, because I'll leave it until later. So what we get when things happen in nursing is knee-jerk reactions all the time. Something's got to change. We've got to change the education. We've got to add more clinical practice. We've got to do this. We've got to do that. We've got to do the next thing. And the big knee-jerk reaction to the Mid-Staffordshire report was the Fanstead report, which I'll refer to in a few minutes. Just in case I forget, while I've got the figures in my head, the Mid-Staffordshire report had 290 recommendations. 10% of them, exactly 29, were on nursing. There wasn't a single recommendation about medicine. There was recommendations about management and the general things about clinical governance and such like. But nursing was singled out as being, this is where all the problem lay. I was so angry I wrote a blog about it. But, it clearly didn't make any sense at all. I mean, everybody was part of that awful culture that developed, but the knee-jerk reaction kicked in, to coin a phrase. So we get initiatives by the score. I mean, we never see the end of the freight train of initiatives comes rolling down the line all the time. This must happen, that must happen. But unfortunately, the juggernaut of evidence to support these things never appears, because we're on to the next initiative before we can get there. And again, the Francis report was a typical example of that. I think seriously only one of those recommendations regarding nursing has been implemented at all, and it's not one of the best ones. Most of the recommendations were fairly ill-advised. So that's the Francis report for 2013. It's been with us for a couple of years, 3 years now, and it's more or less a strip already. So the thing is, we have these massive inquiries, massive reports published, huge expense, and nothing really happens, nothing really changes. Okay, so what I thought I would do is base my public understanding of nursing around four things you didn't know about nurses. I'm sure some of you in the room do know these things, but I thought I'd base it around this. I thought I'd start with 10 things, and I whittled down to 5, and I thought really there were only 4 things I could really find uniquely. I don't mean that's there aren't more things about nursing than you can say, but I thought these were things which I could base a fairly light-hearted session around, and the things for which there is clear evidence are things which I think are counter often to what people actually understand or know about nursing. I did put a tweet out asking for people for more ideas. I did get some. I asked my editorial colleagues in terms of advanced nursing. I got some ideas, but I stuck to these four, but I hope we can build them up over the years. I'd like to write an article for The Conversation, that's an online newspaper. They love 10 things about and 5 things about. I've never seen anything that's 4 things about, so I'm struggling to think of the fifth one. Maybe you could tell me afterwards. But we wouldn't have time to do any more anyway. So the 4 things that you probably didn't know about nursing, and I think that often nurses don't know these things about nursing, is we're a highly trusted profession, and there's good evidence to show that. nurses have degrees. This is a big surprise to lots of people. All nurses coming into registration now in the UK enter with a degree. Not all nurses have degrees yet, but we're moving that way. And of course, Edinburgh was the first of the European departments or European universities to actually educate nurses to degree level. So nurses have degrees. I put that in because I deliberately want to say something about degree education for nurses. Nurses run clinics, simple way of putting it, but nurses run their own workloads, they run their own show in many places. It's been happening for quite a while. It's going to get a lot more common with the way things are going in the National Health Service and the way that, you know, doctors are shortage of doctors. Doctors are more expensive, we're cheaper, but also we're effective. I'll try and show some evidence on that. And finally, nurses do research, and this is an excuse to squeeze in a bit of my own research, some other research as well. So, we're a highly trusted profession. Trust me, I'm a nurse. You don't hear many people saying that when they're rushing through a crowd, but say, you know, trust me, I'm a nurse. Now, here's an interesting digression before I get on to show you how trusted we are. This is an Ipsos Mori poll. This is the one that the Reader's Digest use when they look at the popularity and trustworthiness of professions. And if you look at the top, doctors are the most trustworthy, teachers, judges, scientists, hairdressers. Now, you won't be able to see this from the back, folks, but if you look at that list, what you're not seeing on there is nurses. Now, the Ipsos Mori poll were not considered to be a profession, so we don't appear in this. So that's a rather strange thing that irritates me a little bit. However, the Independent newspaper to the rescue, doesn't exist anymore, but this was their survey of 2,000 people by opinion, and on the left, nurses are the most trusted profession, then doctors, then the armed forces, and then teachers. Down at the very bottom, politicians. Just before that, tabloid journalists and broadsheet journalists. It's a good job we don't have any journalists here tonight. Sorry, Erwin, there is a journalist here tonight. And he's taking notes. But anyway, you know, we are. And I know that's a small sample, although for a research project that would probably be quite a big sample. But I've looked at the figures in the United States. Nursing usually comes second after medicine. In Australia, we consistently come top, but not absolutely always. Sometimes paramedics come top before nurses. That just shows you the dangers of giving women the vote. Sorry, that's a sexist joke. We're always near the top on these polls. So we're a highly trusted profession. I don't think we appreciate that. I think we tend to do ourselves down a little bit and not to realise that actually the public does trust us. So where do we get the impression that we're not trusted from? Where do we get this negative attitude and negative image often about our profession? Well, I'm sad to say it's from politicians and the press, so down at the bottom there, and I'll show you some examples of that. And by press, I usually mean columnists. I'm going to show you some examples in a second. But first of all, I want to deal with the issue of nurses having degrees, at least second of all, which again, is not only, I think it's maybe not such a shock to people these days, there's been plenty of publicity about it, but it still comes as a surprise that they might need them. And why do they need them? Why do they need degrees? Doesn't make any difference. It must make them worse carers. Well, we'll see. Apologies for that rather unpleasant looking picture, but it's the one that was used in the front of my conversation piece that I wrote on nursing degrees, which I thought might be apt. But anyway, over the years, there's been a great deal of publicity in the broadsheets about nursing, and I haven't dredged up everything here. I've got a huge file of things here. Sorry for the quality of this. It's just a scan or an iPhone photograph of a newspaper article by Minette Maron. Now, Minette is usually on the side of the angels. If you hear her talking about education and most social issues, she writes in the Sunday Times. She's very good. She has this almost pathological hatred of nurses going to university. It's just unbelievable. And she's consistent about it. And I've got several articles by her. The headline there says it all. It's all to do with wanting to be equal with doctors and all the rest of it. It's just got nothing to do with it whatsoever, I'm sure. Minette stepped too far with one article where she said that essentially what we were doing by having degree education for nurses was excluding a career pathway for young girls, you know, who had a good heart and, you know, who would be caring and would be excellent nurses and all the rest of it. Don't know how you can be an excellent nurse if you just have a caring heart, but never mind. The point being that I brought this up with an American web page called The Truth About Nursing. It's based on Susan Coleman's book there. And Manette Maron emailed me to ask me to stop because her email was completely jammed. She couldn't use it, so they just absolutely flooded it. I said, well, publish something that says otherwise, you know, listen to the truth. I sent her various articles, which I'm going to show here from, you know, a while back that showed that it was otherwise, and she just wouldn't budge at all. I think her email's probably working again now, but the too posh to wash scenario. This is used all the time. This comes from the Daily Mail from a long, long time ago. This just keeps coming up. Nurses are now too posh to wash. They've got degrees, they've got ideas above their station, and of course, because they've got degrees, they can't do nursing as well as they would otherwise. Well, we'll see. And here's a man who, again, is usually on the side of the angels, Theodore Dalrymple, or Anthony Daniels. I don't quite know why he's got to use a nom de plume. He doesn't write anymore. He used to write for the Telegraph regularly on medical and health matters. He was a prison doctor. Usually very good. Again, a man with an absolute pathological dislike of anything to do with nurses having degrees. Again, sorry, Florence, no degree, no job. And he said, this is what he says here, this is one of the most inflammatory statements I've ever read about our profession, and I'll read it out in full, just the yellow bit, so you get it. Get the full blast at the back. He's comparing nurses with medicine, and I don't see why you've got to do that. But of course, medicine is a university course with a very large element of apprenticeship about it, but medicine is both a learned profession and a severely practical art, which nursing is not and is never likely to be. Now, I don't know which part of that he said it would never be, it would not be part of that, but I just find that really just absolutely and totally offensive. It got worse because he said a university degree denotes possession of intelligence, which clearly implied that nurses don't need. So anyway, this sort of stuff just pours out all the time. It never really stops. Oh, we're not finished yet. Alison Pearson, another good writer, I think, in the Telegraph. Nurses shouldn't carry the bedpan for this crisis. What she said was making nursing a degree-ending profession was a disaster. It was like decreeing that motherhood should be for graduates only. You automatically excluded many of the best and gentlest candidates. Well, I mean, how would she know that? And in fact, she's wrong. So let's have a look and see why she's wrong. As I say, they're entitled to their opinion, but you're not entitled to their facts, and the facts speak otherwise. And if you don't pay attention to any other part of the lecture, this is the part that she's. What's the evidence? What's the evidence about nurses having degrees or having modern education being detrimental? Well, the Willis Commission reported in 2012, Lord Phil Willis put together a commission on behalf of the RCA to look into this very issue, and their conclusion was, unsurprisingly, we found no evidence that there is somehow a conflict between intellect and compassion, and it goes on to mention the Francis report, but so there was just no evidence. They couldn't find it. I was very glad to see some of my own work, along with colleagues at Salford and Stirling, a National Board for Scotland, a project that we did many years ago, cited in here where we looked at competence of graduates, non-graduates and such like, but it was quoted in the report. So, no evidence there, but that's no evidence rather than evidence. This paper is from the Journal of the American Medical Association, by Linda Aiken and colleagues, Education Levels of Hospitalised Nurses and Surgical Patient Mortality. Outcome data for 232,342 orthopaedic patients. This is to do with survival post-surgery, and this paper has been exceedingly influential. And what Linda says in that paper there is that, in the conclusion, in hospitals with higher proportions of nurses educated at baccalaureate level, bachelor's level or higher, surgical patients experience lower mortality or failure to rescue. So failure to rescue from emergency situations or lower mortality from having undergone the surgery. And the evidence is clear in that paper for this huge study. often gets criticised by economic and some medical colleagues for not being a randomised controlled trial. I'm not entirely sure how you can do a randomised controlled trial of something like this, but anyway, the evidence continues to come in. So influential was it that the Institute of Medicine in the United States published a big report on nursing, and they said they recommended that the proportion of nurses with a bachelor's degree should be increased from 50 to 80%. I'm not saying everybody needs to have a degree necessarily. There may be a trade-off, there may be a zero-sum limit on this one, beyond which you don't get any benefit. We don't know that yet. But certainly the evidence was such that the Institute of Medicine, very influential body in the USA, recommended that we increase the levels in the States. Anyway, that's the United States, you'll say. What about Europe? What about the UK? What about this part of the world here? Well, in 2014, The Lancet published an excellent paper, again Linda Aiken at the helm, with a whole bunch of luminaries, including Anne-Marie Rafferty, at the back of the room. And this is the outcome of the RN forecast, the Registered Nurse Forecast Study across Europe. I was glad to see my name there. I was a reviewer of this paper for The Lancet, and I was able to write a comment on it with a colleague of mine from Italy, Lisa Palese. And we were very complimentary about the paper. And it's one of the few papers I've refereed and hardly made a comment on at all. I think I made one comment about natural frequencies as opposed to percentages and so, this was based on 422,730 patients aged 50 years or older who underwent common surgeries in 300 hospitals in 9 European countries. A big study across several countries, I think you'll agree. So what did they find out in this study? And again, I'm always with trepidation reporting somebody else's work, especially when they're in the room. I hope I get it right, and Anne-Marie can correct me afterwards if I don't. But the findings were that an increase, it was about graduate nurses, workload, the whole load of parameters, but they focused in on the workload issues and the graduate level of education issue. An increase in a nurse's workload by one patient increased the likelihood of an inpatient dying within 30 days of admission by 7%. Quite simply, the more patients a nurse has to look after, the more likely they are to die. Every 10% increase in bachelor's degree nurses was associated with a decrease in the likelihood by 7%. The more graduate nurses you've got present, the more likely you are to survive. And, of course, this is done across several countries. But I've had the privilege of looking at a PhD that came out of the study, and also some papers that have been submitted to the Journal of Advanced Nursing. These data have been cut into every which way you can, and the effect of graduate nurses rises to the top every single time. It's quite a remarkable observation. And they apply, this is the sort of recommendations, 60% of bachelor's nurses with an average of 6 patients would have almost 30% lower mortality than patients with lower levels of graduate nurses. Those were calculations based from the study. As I say, my one criticism of the study was that it didn't have natural frequencies, but Linda was kind enough to produce these graphs. So that's anybody with a research or mathematical mind will notice immediately the abscissa doesn't go to zero. But anyway, so the slope is exaggerated slightly. But that's nurse staffing per patients going down from 14 to 4, and the expected deaths go from 19 down to 10. That's based on the data from the study. And that's the expected deaths expected with percentages of graduate education. From 10 up to 90%, you get a reduction from 17 down to 3 deaths per 1,000. So it's a noticeable effect. However, more evidence on this is coming to light. There's one, I hope you don't mind me saying, Andrew, there's one issue with the RN forecast study is that you don't specifically tie the actual nurses to the actual incidence of care. It's a general big data linkage between the data from the hospitals on survival and the number of graduate nurses. But there's more evidence coming out, which is more substantial. I think in many ways, methodologically, it takes the RN forecast work forward a bit. It's not quite so big. and it involves a team of people. I'm glad to be part of the study. It's a study from Qatar, and it's the NUGAT study, and various luminaries involved in this. I don't include myself amongst the luminaries. Richard Gray, who is at the Hamad Medical Corporation, Professor of Mental Health Nursing there, leaving soon, going to Australia. Richard was the, along with Annie Topping and myself, over a glass of, I think it was a bottle of wine actually, in the Holiday Inn in Doha, were discussing the Iron Forecast study and wishing we could perhaps do something like it, wish we could have data that we could get hold of. And Richard suddenly said, but we do have the data here. We've got hundreds of thousands of patient incidents where we can link the patient to the actual episode of care through, if you have the appropriate analysis, through the nurse's registration number, because it's all recorded on computer. So we thought, wow, that'd be great. How do we analyse that? Well, we need a big data analyst. And it wasn't Dave Thompson, he used to get a haircut, but this fellow here, Ioannis Skaptaris, from Greece, who worked in Qatar at the time. I met him at the British Embassy in Doha, as one does, and he's a big data analyst. I said, well, there's this guy who does big data analysis, and of course he actually worked in the same department as they did. So he was able to do the analysis and bring the specific incidents of care and the specific nurses and the survival rates together. Anyway, cutting to the chase, what we found was that patient mortality drops as the average level, and this is the proportion of graduate BSc level education increases. And, again, a striking effect. It doesn't go on forever. It levels out at a certain stage. So we're not saying you need everyone to be a graduate. There may well be a proportion that's effective. But, certainly within the beginning of that graph, the effect is noticeable. Now, one criticism of this kind of work is from the people who would naysay the effect of graduate nursing education is as follows. They say, well, it doesn't really matter who's looking after them. It's really the person who admits them that's important, because they set them on the right path to care, they get the right care, they get the right doctors in. The right will put that to the test. So we took another data set and we analysed that. We looked at the effect of the admitting nurse, whether they were a graduate or not, not taking into account the exposure to graduate nursing through the care pathway, which this takes into account, no effect whatsoever. Okay, so that's not published yet, so I can't put the data up yet. We're still in the throes of getting it published. The Lancet didn't want it. We've actually repeated this study with a separate data set and got exactly the same result. So that's coming out soon, maybe in the Lancet, we'll see. So, as I say, this is real progress in this work, and it can't be beyond the bounds of possibility to try and do this kind of thing with RN forecast kind of data if we can link the care to the actual nurses. So I've labelled that point a bit. I think there's evidence to show that not being a graduate doesn't make you a worse nurse. It actually, for certain parameters, makes you a better nurse. Now, surviving hospital isn't the only outcome of nursing care or hospital care. If you're a palliative care or terminal patient, survival isn't an issue. I do think this work needs to be extended into community care and into other outcomes as well. Again, it can't be beyond the bounds of possibility to do that. So let's have a quick look at the Francis report and see what he said, and then get on to something else to do with evidence. One of the recommendations was that these are all saying the same thing. Basically, they're saying that there should be an increased focus on the practical as well as the theoretical requirements of delivering compassionate care. Training should be reviewed to ensure sufficient practical elements are incorporated for a consistent national standard. I mean, nurse education has always been 50% practical. I trained as a nurse. I didn't go to university as a nurse. I did a traditional training course. Half of our time was spent in the hospital, half of the time was spent in the school. University students, certainly at Hull, do half the time in the clinical practice, half of it in the university. Same at Edinburgh, same at Birmingham. That's the regulation. You spend half your time doing it practically. So it's really difficult to know what this really means. But the outcome of that was that there should be a period of 3 months of working in the direct care of patients before you come into nursing, and that would solve the problem of people not being good nurses with TB. They need some exposure beforehand. He said 3 months, I think the government said a year, and it's being pilot tested. I've got no idea where that's got to. I think it's probably disappeared. Maybe somebody can tell me afterwards. But the point is, I was an auxiliary for 12 months before I became a nurse, and I can distinctly remember learning things that now would make my hair stand on end when I look back. You know, it doesn't necessarily make you a better nurse. I learned to put tea, milk and sugar in the same pot, for instance, for patients with learning disabilities because they wouldn't know any better, that kind of thing. You know, it's shocking. You know, so I was about a bit doubtful about this. But is there any evidence? Well, interestingly, the evidence, Rosie Stenner, is Rosie here tonight? No, Rosie's from the University of Edinburgh. Paper just published recently in Nurse Education Today said, do emotional intelligence and previous caring experience influence student nurse performance? A comparative analysis. Now, the performance here was performance over the first year of the programme. It was educational and clinical performance put in together, and also measuring emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence doesn't seem to be altered at all by previous exposure to caring or not having previous exposure. Emotional intelligence is a difficult thing to define in any case. It's nothing to do with intelligence. It's probably personality or disposition. So what they measured was, they looked the data two ways. They looked at the different age groups, and they looked at previous caring experience versus no previous caring experience, and looked at the mean total for the performance over the year of the nurses, and in almost in every one apart from the 31 to 35 age group, those with no caring experience performed better than the other ones without it. If you look at it overall, I know it's not a very box and whisker plot there, not a very striking result, but statistically significant was that the people with on the right, the green ones, people with previous caring experience, on the left without previous caring experience, the ones on the right performed less well. Now, that's only one study, I know it's being carried on, it's going to be repeated, but so far the evidence doesn't support what the government seems to want. So often the evidence doesn't go with what people think is common sense and the right thing to do. Okay, check the time. Nurses run clinics. Now, there's lots of evidence about this. Sorry for that terrible thing. I did have the PDF and lost it, but this is it's a really nice article in the Nursing Standard about removal of foreign bodies from children's ears, a nurse-led clinic. One study again, I know I'm going to show you other ones as well. Really the background to this is that reducing junior doctor's hours, you know, means that they're less available, care outcomes are not necessarily so good, and training nurses up to do certain jobs that they would normally do could be an effective way of helping. And specialist nurses in various clinics have been found to be cost effective. We've already got evidence on this, and they also reduce unnecessary hospital admissions. And in the Birmingham Children's Hospital, they found that junior doctors' success of getting things out of children's ears and other parts of their bodies as well. Remember our youngest daughter shoving a little football from a game up her nose and having to spend all day in hospital till we got that to come out. But anyway, junior doctors are not quite so good at this, and they found that the success rate was very low. So what they did was trained up nurses to do the job, and they trained them up, and they compared it with registrar and junior doctors at getting things out of children's ears. Again, apologies for the very poor slide. I couldn't find the original PDF to put it up. But basically, stunning result. The success rate for nurse-led practitioner clinic was 91% compared with 7% and 15% for junior doctors and registrar. One study, but pretty impressive, I think you'll agree. Journal of Advanced Nursing, randomised controlled trial of nurse-led rheumatology clinics for monitoring biological therapy. We publish a lot of papers on this. I'm very interested in them. We're not the only journal publishing them, but we do get a lot, and consistently they show the same thing. And there may be, I don't know whether there's a bottom drawer phenomenon where the ones that don't show nursing as being good or equal to medicine gets shoved away. I doubt it somehow. So I think people would want to know, you've always got to be careful when you're looking at this evidence. But basically, in a randomised controlled trial, basically there was no statistical significant difference between the two groups. So nurse-led care and medical-led care for this particular group of patients was equally good. Another study from JAN about primary diabetes management by primary care physicians or by nurse practitioners, a slightly different difference of qualification of nurses. Here they found that all the outcomes, including the cost outcomes, were better for nurses. And there are lots of studies. I'm not doing a systematic review here. That would be a little bit too boring, I think. But there's lots of studies to show this effect. And for things like nurse endoscopy, close to my heart, the available evidence suggests that appropriately trained nurses can perform diagnostic endoscopy safely and with similar outcomes to nursing. Now that's a systematic review of evidence from the York Centre for Reviews and Dissemination, and it's been picked up by the National Institute for Health Research. That's not the top body for reviews like Cochrane, but it's a very, very rigorous system of review. So basically saying that nurses are just as good as doctors at doing this. In fact, there's some studies that show a little bit better because nurses are a little bit more nervous and a little bit more careful when they're doing these diagnostic endoscopies. And I can speak from first-hand experience of having that. Okay, nurses do research. Finish off on this. Nurses do research, which I know we know about. What can we talk about here? Well, I want to talk a little bit about some of my own work, of course, I want to talk about it for a particular reason, to show the uniqueness of something from nursing research and some sort of pioneering work, and things that nursing research has done which are unique, pioneering, different from what's gone before. And my area of interest is nutrition and dementia, particularly feeding difficulty in dementia, and it's an area which is in the domain of nursing, is a phrase that Steve Tilley once gave me, but it's also in the domain of the psychogeriatricians, the occupational therapists, the physiotherapists, you know, and so forth. There's lots of people potentially involved in this. But I'm glad to say, it's only nurses who've really pioneered and done anything worthwhile about it, in my view. And from this Alzheimer's Disease International report on nutrition and dementia from 2014, I was very glad to see, this doesn't really work, the EdFed, you know, please don't read all that. The EdFed is the Edinburgh Feeding Evaluation Dementia Scale, developed by myself and Ian Deary, who's here tonight. And the most remarkable thing, it was effusive about the scale. It went on to explain how it's used and to say that it's been widely psychometrically tested and such like. The remarkable thing to me is that this was developed, I think the first papers were published in 1994, possibly before that, but 1994 is what I remember for the main papers from the study. It remains the only validated instrument for measuring brain difficulty in the world. There isn't another one, and it's such a simple scale. It's widespread. It's used in the States. It's used in China. I came across it in Japan once from the Institute of Gerontology and Geriatrics in Tokyo. I saw a scale. I said, "What's that scale?" I said, "Oh, it measures feeding difficulty." And I said, "It looks very much like one I know." And they said, "Yeah, it is Edinburgh." I said, "That's mine." You know, so it had been translated and was being used there, which was very pleased about. Then another study which I'm peripherally involved. The importance of the EdFed is I don't think it's necessarily led to great improvements in feeding patients with dementia. I have to say it's an assessment tool. We don't really know what to do, and that's one of the issues. And this study by Lee Chan Lin, who's a very good friend of mine, and Graham Smith's here from Taiwan, carried out, this is a study of space retrieval and Montessori-based activities in improving eating immunity for patients with dementia, published in the International Journal of Geriatric Psychiatry. I was involved in this because they used the EdFed and they wanted advice on how to use it and how to measure the outcomes. And the important thing about this study is it's the first ever fully powered, randomised controlled trial of a feeding intervention designed to alleviate feeding difficulty. It's the first one ever. There have been lots of smaller studies, lots of very poorly designed studies, lots of studies with very vague outcomes. But this was specifically designed to look at feeding difficulty. And both space retrieval and Montessori activities work. You probably know about Maria Montessori, who developed a sort of specific educational method for children, breaking things down into small tasks and such like. I'm not the expert on the method at all. And space retrieval is slightly different. That's the route. I love these old papers printed like this by Landauer, Optimum Rehearsal Patterns for Name Learning. And he describes space retrieval as being beginning with a prompting question. If you can repeat the task again, you increase the interval to the next task and so on. That's the basis of space retrieval. And basically that graph shows at the top that, this is not from the feeding study, it's from his original paper, that spacing retrieval times as opposed to having constant times increases the retrieval. This was a memory task, but it also works for feeding tasks as well. And we then followed it up with a crossover study which showed the same thing. Feeding difficulty was alleviated. That was just using the Montessori method. And now a couple of other papers have come out, which I'm not involved with, published by Lee Chan, using combined space retrieval and Montessori, showing that it's effective at alleviating feeding difficulty. It also works for behavioural problems and such like. And there's been a systematic review of Montessori and space retrieval recently, and there's been a huge review of two reviews of indirect and direct methods of alleviating feeding difficulty, and these studies have featured prominently and they're published in BMC Geriatrics. Right, finally, nursing research gets reported. I think we don't often realise this. We hear a lot of medical research and economic research, all sorts of things on Radio 4 in the morning. And I hope I can get this to work.
I can. Now, just imagine my surprise. I was still lying in bed, and I heard this.
Willa Davis reporting there. The time is now 10:07. It was Andy Smith. Will Davis is our man in Rio. We like to think that when we are under the knife, the surgeon is concentrating 100% on the job in hand. But what if music's playing in the background in the operating theatre? Well, there's a study being published in the Journal of Advanced Nursing that suggests it might prove distracting. I'm joined by Sharon Weldon, who is the lead author of the study, and Dr. Omar Khan, consultant surgeon at Whittington Hospital. What's the evidence for the distraction theory, Sharon Weldon?
Well, we weren't looking at the surgeons alone, we were looking at team communication.
So, you noticed that John Humphreys coughed a little bit before he said the John Advanced Nursing. I think he's expected to say something else. But anyway, so there's John Humphreys, who's the luckiest man in the world, getting to spend long times in the morning with Misha Hussain. But anyway, that was John Humphreys. And he is somebody who is not very positive about nursing and academic nursing. And he's said a few things on the radio which have irritated me in the past. And I know from one colleague of his who I've done some work with that he thinks, doesn't really take view very positively. But I just have to say, I just thought, for me, certainly for the Journal of Advanced Nursing, but I also thought for nursing research, wasn't a piece of my research, it was a piece that we published in Journal of Advanced Nursing. It was a pinnacle. We're actually getting there. We're getting through this image problem, and we need to do more to publish our research. We need to think about there, get people like this to notice, to get it onto Radio 4 in the mornings if we possibly can. Okay, I said finally and I lied. This is finally. I'm just going to leave you with an image that meant a lot to me in my childhood. And I'm not just showing, this is the Good Samaritan, I'm not just showing you this because I'm, as Frank Skinner would say, a follower of the Nazarene, as I am. But I think the story can be taken in any other context. The Good Samaritan, it was a story told to illustrate good neighbourship. Who's your neighbour? And of course the Good Samaritan is the neighbour because he stopped that the person had been beaten up by the robbers and had his money taken away. But I mean, anybody could stop there and not be affected. But what always impressed me about this story, or at least impressed me more when I came into nursing, was what it said, what he did. He said he went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. I think the Good Samaritan, he may not have had a degree, but I think he was an example of one of the first nurses, or male nurses, that I've certainly seen. I'm not concerned about male or female nurses, but I think he was that. But my point here is that, this is what we do. You know, we do something practical for people, and if we get it right, if we educate our nurses properly, if we nurture them as individuals, if we nurture the profession by developing the evidence base philosophically and empirically, and we do things like this and we get it right, we make people better. Thanks very much.
Wonderful, thank you so much. What a journey through the evidence, the importance of nursing, and the importance of nursing for pretty fundamental things like survival of patients and things like that. I hope that you're talking to the converted here, but nonetheless, the message, as you say, is still unfortunately too strong that nurses do not need to be educated, that having a strongly educated workforce is an unnecessary part of modern healthcare. I think tonight you've really helped us put together an argument and a form of words that all of us can take out into those conversations that we all have to deal with sometimes, and actually kind of knock those on the head a little bit. Thank you. We have 10 minutes, I think, about that, getting on for that.
Absolutely.
To take a few questions. So can I invite anyone to ask questions? Roger, you might need to come back up here and answer a few questions.
It's not compulsory to ask questions, especially if you're a journalist.
Sheila, there was somebody right at the back who popped their hand up briefly.
Liz.